G'day guys, welcome back to the Dylan Friends podcast. This week, my old player manager, Matty Bain. Bainey's been an AFL manager now for over 10 years, and I thought this would be a super week to get him on and have a chat about what it's like to be a manager, how it all works, and especially with silly season upon us, how all the trades, delistings, and contract negotiations go down. So Matty gives us a bit of an insight into how the managers go about their trading, finding good deals for their players, how clubs approach him and talk about potential trades, and what is even in a contract in terms of triggers, bonuses, or clauses. Very insightful stuff. Can't thank Bainey enough for his time, and I hope you enjoy the show. Let's go.
Welcome to the Dylan Friends podcast. My name is Deborah, Dylan's mum. Strap yourselves in for some lighthearted and wholesome fun. And don't forget to subscribe and leave a review.
Matthew Bain, welcome to the Dylan Friends podcast, my friend. Normally I say, you know, this one's been in the making for a while, but it has been, but it's been the other way. You have been hustling me to come on the podcast for a long time, and now I've got you on, and I'm very excited because you're a great man, and there's plenty to learn from this one, especially this time of year, because it's when you come into the biggest power mode. You're very busy, headphones are in, and it's game time for you.
The AirPods are in. Thanks for having me, Dil. Well, ever since you started the podcast, I've sort of been angling towards it. But yeah, as it's got longer and longer, it's probably the guests have got better and better. So I've slipped down the order, but mate, rapt to get a call up. So thanks.
No, of course, mate. You're very high up on the list. But I wanted to wait for the right time to do this because we have chatted about doing this for a long time. And being yourself, to set the background, you were my manager when I was a player in the AFL. Which we will get into because there wasn't a whole lot to manage, I suppose, in my career. There wasn't sort of... I think we've got contrary views on this because I'm leaning towards the fact that you were my player manager, but in terms of my playing contracts, there wasn't a lot of work that was needed to be done in those contracts.
Which is fine, but that's what we're going to get into, mate, because sometimes they're the hardest ones to deal with.
Yeah, so. I think, look, this is my show, so I think you should just show me some respect throughout it just to remember that. But okay. What I'm saying is the deals that we'll talk about later on, often it was, you know, this is the deal. You know, can we have an extra couple dollars? No, we can't. Okay, thank you. We'll sign it.
Yeah.
And go on. But as I said, mate. So I
think one of our one-year deals took about 8 months to do, though, and used to call me about four times a week going, surely Soss can give me an extra $5,000.
Yeah, I do remember that.
Yeah, I think you're selling yourself a bit short about how much work I had to put into you.
Okay,
but that's all right.
Okay.
We'll get into it.
We will. The big points, though, that I think are big to talk about this time of year, and just especially with managers, mate, because it's a funny one, the management path. I think a lot of people in the public probably wouldn't know what managers really do besides the fact of contracts, but I suppose there's other things that really go ahead, especially with, you know, the bigger sort of name players, and we'll get into who you've got. One being, you know, Paddy Cripps and someone like that take a lot more work with things sort of off field and things like that. But other things as well, man, like the trade period at the moment and silly season, I've always been a massive fan. Even when I was playing, and I suppose we touched on it earlier, but signing like one-year deals was obviously an anxious time for me, but it was actually, as a footy fan, I loved watching trade period, like as just like what goes on behind closed doors, knowing what, you know, what's happening all the time. So I suppose those sort of things as well. And I think it'd be cool to break it down. And to be honest, I thought I knew a little bit about this, but I actually don't know a great deal because I was probably never in those positions.
Yeah, it's exciting time. I think even for the guys about to be traded or looking for more opportunities, it's a good time in your life. But especially the last probably 4 or 5 years, it's grown to something pretty big. You look how big trade radio's become, and I think it's just an extension of the season. People love getting a footy fix.
Yeah, they definitely do. Let's break it down though, mate. Yourself, obviously, you've been a manager now for how many years?
Just over 10.
Over 10 years. Been working with TLA. Yep. Originally, you were with Stride.
Stride, yeah.
How did it all work, man? How did it all come to fruition for you? Where did you get a start?
My older brother got drafted. He was in and out for a year, but watching him go through the process with the manager, I was like, well, I was never good enough to get picked. So I was never going to. So I was like, it's a good way to stay involved in the industry. So I did a Bachelor of Business at uni, and then I started to get a bit of work experience behind me. So I went overseas. I was lucky enough to get a couple of good gigs. I worked at the Monaco Grand Prix, the Tour of Italy. Then I came back and worked at the Commonwealth Games. And from there, it sort of just ticked along. I had 2 years at Carlton working in the membership department, which was good fun early days. From there, I met Tom Petroro, who was at Stride at the time, Glenn Archer, Ricky Ponting and some of those guys. And then, yeah, I was lucky enough to get a gig, mate, and that sort of worked in from there.
It's funny you say you worked in the membership department, because I used to think that I used to actually work in the membership department as well, putting bums on seats. More on field performance, I was putting, you know, selling memberships actually firsthand. But I appreciate you filling out the paperwork for me on the, you know, with that.
You're always good to the fans, though. You weren't good to the fans. But,
yeah. Oh, that was the worst gag ever. In talking to that,
I don't know where to go.
Yeah, no. In terms of starting out as a manager, though, you obviously it's a career where you don't. There's no pathway. Like, you don't go to uni and study player management per se.
Yeah.
How does it work? Yeah. Like, are you thrown into that and they just go, right, now you've got to go out, you've got to go watch under-18s and sign up young kids? Or do they give you guys, like, how do you learn about it? How do you learn the negotiations and how to sign up players?
I offered to Tommy originally at Stride. I said, I'll do 2 days work experience for nothing. I just wanted to get in the industry and really learn about it. So I did that for, I think it was about six to eight months or something like that. Literally getting the coffees, mate, and doing filing and a few different things. So, and then I suppose from there started to learn a couple of things. And I said, I really want to dive into this. So the next step was to get my accreditation, which is a pretty lengthy process. It's a lot tougher than some people think it is. So I went and got that. And then I probably had a year and a half just learning the ropes off, and I just tried to absorb as much as I possibly could. And then from there, it was time to go and get some of my own clients. So I got half gifted my first client. I remember Zephaniah Skinner. Remember him from the Doggies?
Yeah, he's a gun.
Big rat's tail. He was my first ever client, which I love him to bits, still talk to him a fair bit. So and that was sort of thrown in the deep end a little bit, and then just went from there.
How weird is that, like, going and talking to 16, 17-year-old kids talking about management? Because I remember when I was in that position, you think you are the king. Like, you're at school.
Well, that's half the issue.
Yeah, I know. It didn't work out well for me. But I remember how good you think you are at that stage. You know, you're talking about managers and trying to get players signed up, but also as well, you don't want to get their hopes up if things don't work out.
Yeah. It's one of the parts I love about the job is going and meeting new people, and you actually become really close with them as you know, but get to meet great families, and it's really good fun. It's probably sometimes you go to some houses and, you know, you meet players or whatever it is. You're like, maybe they're not for me, sort of thing. And that can be a bit tedious, but I think you've got to see it as a really good fun part of the job, meeting new people. And but managing expectations is huge right across, like right down to someone like yourself currently still. Like, you've got to manage expectations of what clients are after, and that's the part of a role of a good manager is being able to work through that.
What is a day-to-day life like for a manager? Because even for me, like, I know you obviously work with me in my playing career, and there's things that, you know, we try and do throughout the week, whether that's, you know, contract negotiation is a major one, but, you know, it might be sort of, for me, it was always big on, you know, off field, what can I do here, what can I do there, thinking about setting things up. I spoke to, obviously, Brett DeLeo last week, one of my good mates, and he's transitioning into management now, and spoke about how important it is to set up kids on and off the field, especially off field, you know, like banking and learning how to manage money. What is a role of a player manager? What does your week look like? What are some of the things you do that, you know, people wouldn't know that managers do?
Yeah, I think it's probably a bit of a misinterpretation that managers are just all about contracts, because really, if you play for 10 years, you might have 4 or 5 contracts, maybe 3, you know. How many do you have in the end?
About 10.
A couple of one-years. But it is a pretty small part of it. I think the welfare role at the moment is huge, being able to talk to players during the week and get their mindset, and we'll probably go into that a little bit more after. But, yeah, there's a whole heap of different things, media, marketing. The financial side's huge, because you get one really good shot at making something out of footy, and you got to make sure that if you have a career that lasts like my older brother did for 1 year, or some of the boys you see play 15 years, that you're making the most out of it, because you don't want to come out of footy going, well, what's next? So that's important. And I think it's a bit cheesy. It's sort of like a bit of a life coach in a way. Mm. And I wish I had someone when I was a lot younger teach me some of the things, because I just don't think schools necessarily teach you great things coming out at times around life skills. So I've got guys that I manage that go to the best private schools in Australia that at the age of 18 don't know what superannuation is or tax or net pay, gross pay. So just teaching them about things so that you're not just pushing pieces of paper in front of people and saying sign here, you know.
Mm.
So just teaching them sort of little life goals along the way.
No, it's a huge point, I think, mate, because even looking back to my career now, and not just managers and yourself, but even just being in an AFL system, like the guys and girls that go through being AFL players, you nearly get not just AFL players, I'd say professional sports in teams. Like you get a bit of a degree in life, like in terms of like things you learn and things that, you know, it might take an everyday person to learn these things, you know, throughout their whole time. I take them to get to, you know, sort of 30, 40 years of age where you're experiencing these things as an 18-year-old and you might not actually know how important they are yet until it finishes.
You've got to make decisions a lot quicker than a lot of people around you growing up. I mean, it's just because your income's growing a lot quicker too, and you've got to make the most of those opportunities. So there's not many 21-year-olds out there that are setting up family trusts and, you know, buying a house at the age of 20 and doing different things like that, learning about shares. And so it's important to be able to teach younger guys about that and why they're putting money into certain places. Like, and that's just an educational thing from our point of view. We obviously have financial advisors that go and do everything, but it's just making sure they're understanding of it more than anything.
Talking of player contracts, and we touched on it before, negotiations, as I said, we didn't have much negotiating power there, but in a lot of your other players on the books, you know, you've got guys like, who have you got? You've got Paddy Cripps, Sam Doherty, Luke Shuey,
Tim Membry, Jay Gresham, Tim Taranto. Got a fair few.
Mm. So how early do contract negotiations start with that? Like if a player signs a 1-year deal, a 2-year deal, you know, does the club come to the player? Does the manager go to you? How do the conversation start? Is there one way it happens or does it change up?
Yeah, it changes up a little bit. Sometimes you've got different types of players. Some players really like security in their contract. So some might come and say, mate, get me the longest deal possible and the money's not much of an issue, where others are a bit riskier and like to take them on and let their contracts run out and try and get a little bit more money, or they're not as fussed about having security in the system. So you deal with, and that's the fun part about footy, you deal with all different types. So, but I think when a player gets drafted, normally a club, if you're in the first probably 25, club normally comes pretty early to do an extension. And especially if you're in the top 10, they normally try and push them out early. So, but then across the board, as I said, sometimes, you know, I'll be 2 years out, a player will be, you know, out in 2022 or something, and they'll start coming now and saying, well, we're happy to push him out if the player does, you know, and extend him, where other boys will say, no, run me right through to the back end of that year. I'm happy to sit and wait.
You said then about young players, and this is something, again, that it's happened in the last few years, I think, but young players now, especially from interstate clubs, are signing those long deals for, you know, really big money early days. But a lot of people are saying that can actually come back and hurt the clubs now, because they're signing these massive bomb deals early and there's not much to grow into, and it could just be taking up heaps of their salary caps.
Yeah, but I think they probably look at the negative ones or the ones that haven't worked that well, and that's probably why they're saying that. Mm. There's some that probably have signed early and have worked really well. So, and I think that's probably just the market when the Gold Coast and Giants came in, is that there were so many of those players there that there was a monopoly and you'd be able to go in there and take a couple out and pay them a little bit over. So naturally the club said, well, right, I will sort of have to half match what you're going to get offered down to Victoria or to move back home. So we'll start to increase your pay in those early years.
Just on that move back home factor, I think that will be dead in the next 2 years. I have a massive theory now of being in Sydney and live there myself and enjoyed how much it is a beautiful life up there away from footy. You get to play the sport that you love, but you don't have to be in the spotlight and you can enjoy the beach and whatnot. I've heard from a few people that the request from after the hub life in Gold Coast that Gold Coast have received of players wanting to be traded to the club is astounding. Can you comment on that?
I think it has opened a few people's eyes. Yeah, well, it's opened a few people's eyes to say, well, you know, it's all these players live in an environment where, you know, it's hard to go out and have a dinner and, you know, have a few beers. And I know that hasn't been up in the Gold Coast or in the hub life. You can't do that. But I reckon some of them probably enjoy being out of the spotlight a little bit and not having eyes cast over them all the time. But it goes both ways, mate. Like, as you said, you thought you were the king when you got to Carlton. Mm. I remember you strutting around everywhere on the sidelines in your tracksuit early days when you weren't even playing.
Yeah,
signing autographs in the second level at the G when you were getting a pie at half time. So, yeah, like there's that part of it that I think players really like is but it also becomes really consuming as well. So when you are playing in front of low crowds and, you know, interstate, it can be a bit of an attraction to go, I want to go to a big club. I want to feel what it's like. But I think some that have felt that and then move go, you know, this life's amazing because I don't have the expectation or the, yeah, the public spotlight onto me. And that's probably what you felt a little bit, go, well, I've probably experienced playing in front of big crowds and now I've flipped it the other way. But it's a balance, mate. And I say to a lot of the players that are interstate that are thinking about moving, well, why would you? Because you're getting paid well and you get to live this lifestyle.
Yeah. Yeah. It was always something I think is if you look at early days with the Giants and there wasn't, and obviously, you know, a few guys have put in requests to move, but that's for different sort of issues now and setting up their lives post footy. But if you look at the young guys that sort of leave Giants and Gold Coast early and not putting words in their mouth, but I always think that a lot of them might think, geez, I wish I sort of probably stuck out a couple more years interstate.
Yeah, but don't forget they probably would have had opportunities to go back at other clubs in Melbourne too that, to play in, you know, in the midfield or, you know, play in different positions that might not have got picked at the Giants because you were so stacked. But on the flip side, as I said before, like Sydney, especially at the Giants, provides such a good environment to live. Like you've lived and breathed it. So that's the trade-off. Like you don't play in front of massive, massive crowds, although the Giants' numbers are building really well and they're an amazing footy club at the moment. But at the same time, you get to live a life and go and have a swim down Bondi and do your thing without that public spotlight.
What are some of the craziest clauses you've seen in contracts and requests? You know, like people might not understand what goes into a contract. It's a massive document. It's got obviously things that, you know, there's triggers, clauses and requests that you can put in there. What's something that goes into a contract and how long can these negotiations go for?
Mate, there's not that many crazy clauses. Like, did you try to put a Coleman medal clause?
I did. I put one up.
For you?
Yeah.
For the knee fall?
I'm pretty sure they said would give you $1 million, they were that confident it wouldn't happen.
there's not many. Like, to be honest, like if when your player comes to do a contract, you really manage their expectations around money and what the market rate is for them at the time. So you probably don't get many players that think they're way above what they should be. And if they trust their manager and the person in charge, that they sort of, you have really good open dialogue, but it's not something that you sit there and you're that far apart on. So, clauses are a bit different. And the AFL knock a lot of clauses on the head now. So if you put something obscure in there, they probably just knock it back and say, this is ridiculous. So I've had a couple of players that have been injured and they have, you know, 10, 12 clauses in there to make sure that they can earn the money should they get back and play the footy they think they can. So, but as far as, yeah, stupid clauses, not too many.
What about triggers though, like in terms of guys in contracts of like Brownlow bonuses, Coleman medals, these things, is that actually goes ahead?
Yeah, yep, best and fairest. There's probably not a hell of a lot of Brownlow and All Australian incentives there used to be. When I first started, that used to be the big rage, but clubs don't love putting them in there because, you know, it's subjective, like a Brownlow clause, you know, the umpires vote for it. So it's not necessarily, you know, like it's not necessarily something the clubs love having in there. They put probably best and fairest because that means that the club are voting on it, but, you know, you're rated internally there especially. So, and I like sometimes, you know, some players will finish higher up in the best and fairest, like a defender, for example. There's no chance to get Brownlow votes, just the way that the system works. So, you put a couple in there, but yeah, there's probably more games triggers, like as you would have expected into yours. If you play, you know, let's just say a random contract, if you're on 120,000, but the following year, if you play, you know, 10 games, 14, 16 and 18, you jump up to, you know, 140, 60, 80, you know, 200 or something if you play 18 the following year. So that's probably more the structure and the match payments and stuff like that, rather than the bigger deals.
And when you sit down with these contracts, a person at the club, which was someone I never quite saw eye to eye with, but always had immense respect for, was a list manager. Now, I reckon that's got to be the hardest job in footy, because these guys, like, they obviously work for the club, they love the club with all the passion, but they have to have a really interesting relationship with players, because they probably can't get too close to them, because they're the person that sort of is the one that's going to be giving them.
Remember you and Soss's relationship? You used to shit yourself every time.
It was such an awkward experience. Even, like, you know, I love Soss and still do, but obviously at that time, you know, we both were not oblivious to what was going on. Like, I knew that he was going to sack me, and he knew that he was going
to sack
me.
Remember you used to ring me? You're like, man, I saw Soss Asavo, man. I just walked the other way. It was so awkward.
Oh, it was so awkward. And even, you know, even with Jace, like Jace McCartney was at the Giants. Like, yeah. I've known Jace since I was 15 years old, and, you know, we had an amazing relationship, but it got to the stage where I was just like, Jace, man, can we just sit down and have a chat? Like, I don't want it to be awkward anymore. Like, I said to him, you know, it's all good. Whatever happens, don't stress.
Yeah. And you were lucky though, mate, because you had two really good ones, relationship wise, because obviously Soss played with your old man. So, and Jace, you knew for a while. So it was actually pretty easy when, you can have honest conversations. I think the hard part is if list managers are keeping things from you or whatever. So, it's obviously part of my role is to communicate that pretty well. So it is a hard role as a list manager, but I think like anything in life, mate, if you're honest and open with people, it makes things a lot easier.
Yeah, and that's what those two guys were really good at for me, especially just being open and honest. And I think you can't in that position, even, you know, in work and outside of footy and even in life, as long as you know, I think one of my biggest downfalls was I was probably too honest with myself of what was going on, and I was very aware of like what was happening. So there was never a stage where I wasn't oblivious to what was going on. I knew it was a business, and I'd rather have a good relationship that's longer lasting than fall out quickly, because we will touch on the listing part next. But in terms of list managers that you've worked with in the AFL, they probably, you know, there is some well-known ones. You know, obviously Stephen Wells at Geelong always gets a really good rap with a lot of the work he's done. Who were some of the best list managers, in your opinion, you've seen in your time dealing with?
Oh, I've dealt with a lot. There's actually not many bad ones, mate, because they don't last very long if they're no good. So I used to work a long time ago with Craig Vozzo from West Coast. I love working with Craig. And to be honest, everyone, mate, I think everyone's in the industry's grown up a fair bit over the last probably 5 or 6 years. When I first started, list managers were quite emotional people. Mm. So, because footy's an emotional sport, and it's probably the business side of footy's taken over a little bit, I guess, recently. But, we sort of try to take the emotion out of it, I reckon, the last 5 years. And it's helped a lot because you don't get the big blow-ups that used to happen. And it can... It's stressful during trade period, and you can see a couple of blow-ups here and there. But I think clubs are much better now. If you're upfront and honest with them, it helps. So, and the good list managers, that's what they are. They don't bullshit around.
Mm, I think it's definitely important, because one thing that you'd know and one thing I've learned in footy is you can't have any enemies in footy, because they might be argument one day, but the next week they'll be rocking up and they'll be a new assistant coach at the club. It's interesting to see, because one of the questions I did have early days, you see, you know, silly season and trade period, and there's all these standoffs. Like, how much, that was the question was going to be, was how much does ego play a role in not getting roles done? Like, is it sometimes just people don't want to do things?
Not really, mate. When you got people's lives at hand, I don't think people mess around and play with that. I think there's a part of it that you have to be really aggressive sometimes and make sure you get the deals through. But I don't think there's a hell of a lot. We were talking the other day if there's any bluffing that happens in sport anymore or with an agent. Like, when you got people's lives at hand, I don't think that's happens as much as it probably used to.
Let's talk about trades, because something I've always been a massive I've always had a lot of questions about how this all works. Like, we see, for example, you know, there's guys that have already requested, you know, free agency now. There's trades that would be going on all year that people don't know about. How early do some of these discussions actually start?
it depends where they're at in their career, because you can get a player that's out of contract at the end of next year that you already know that, you know, they go part of their exit interviews over the next few weeks with all the clubs, and they don't want to leave at the moment, but they probably say, if this is still happening next year, I'm probably going to get out. Or, you know, there might be some conversations over the next 6 weeks of, you know, inquiries from other clubs, and you say, no, he's not going to leave this year, but he's a chance next year, just keep your eye on him, or whatever it is. But and then the ones that are out of contract, or even some that are moving in contract, probably conversations start to heat up halfway through the year, I reckon. A player would probably get a bit of an indication at the start of the year if they're wanting out of the club for whatever reason, or they want to move back home, or if something's happening. But then you get some that literally come out of nowhere a little bit, and it's probably this time of year a player might call and say, mate, I've been having to think for a couple of weeks. But, and this is extremely late for that to happen. There wouldn't be many players that get traded in this period coming up now that haven't at least thought about it or spoken to their manager about it.
Do managers, I was chatting to producer Sam about this before, and I think it's something funny because you sort of hear like deals that go through and no one ever knew about it. Like, for example, that Buddy Franklin deal still rattled me from, you know, 5-6 years ago, how everyone thought he was going to, you know, Giants or somewhere else, and then all of a sudden he just goes bang to Sydney. So I feel like at some stage information doesn't get leaked unless people want it to be leaked. Like, how much of these trade deals do management use, like, the media to actually play up deals and build deals up?
Nah, I think that's a bit of a misconception. Like, you don't really – I love the media and people in the media, but you don't need them to pump your players up. That's just a – yeah, no chance. But it's like anything, mate. Like, if you tell someone one thing and you're like, mate, do not tell a single soul, like – I can see you smirking there. Like, do not tell a single soul. And then, like, 2 days later, someone else goes to you, oh, so-and-so told me this. You're like, how? Like, I'm talking that's in your personal life. But, you know, and it just then just goes like wildfire. So I think that's what happens sometimes. A player will, you know, have a few beers with another teammate. Maybe he says something and then that flows. He tells someone else and it just goes, mate. So it's hard to keep anything confidential in footy. It really, really is. And there's a lot of gossips in footy. And I think, like, you look at the amount of journos, I think there's twice as many as there is players. So unfortunately not at the moment with everything that's happened this year. There's been a few good ones let go. But, it's hard to keep anything a secret.
What happens if you've got two players that you manage and you're both your company and you're trading them? Has that ever happened?
From the same club?
No, from different teams, but you have both of them. Yeah. Or, like, has there ever been an issue where you've had to step away because of conflict of interest or anything like that?
No. What I say in that position is that you'll never – I don't make the decision on a player. So someone always asks me as well, if you had two players at the one club, there's only one spot left, who do you go for? I don't make that call. So you just make the you go hard at the club and you put the best foot forward for both players, and the club's the one at the end of the day that makes the call on who stays and who goes. It's not us. Our job's to push their case as much as possible. And if there's not an opportunity there, you go and find an opportunity elsewhere.
What about this season, mate? Obviously, it's been a strange one. How busy do you think it's going to be in terms of trades, free agency? Is it going to be bigger than normal? Will it be the same? Do we know what's happening with list sizes yet?
No, there's been a lot of talk about list sizes, but that hasn't been worked out yet, which is hard because we're coming up to a period now over the next 6 or 7 weeks where it looks like we'll go into trade maybe not knowing what list sizes are. So hopefully it gets worked out over the next 2 or 3 weeks. The AFLPA.
So does that mean, though, like, if they pick up guys and they've got a list of 44 and then they say you need to bring it down to 36... They just have to
chop. I think they're planning all for that at the moment.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, they're planning that at the moment. Like, there was talk a while ago it might be 38 primary and 2 rookie spots. Last probably few weeks, it's probably hopefully changed to 40 and 2, but we still don't know that. So, but clubs will probably hold a lot more players that are out of contract over at the moment and say you might have to wait and see here. And they'll go and bring guys in at trade that they were going to go after anyway. So, it's going to be a bit different this year, but like everything this year, you've got to change with the times, don't you?
You do. You've got to pivot, my friend. What trades have you been a part of in your time, some of the bigger trades and sort of trades that you're proud of getting through?
Well, Sammy Doherty's one was a big one early days from Brisbane, because that was pretty big at the time with what happened with their coach. And and it was, they were really disappointed to lose him. And Doc's been an amazing story. He's, obviously, we're both pretty close with him. But at the time, he was really, really keen to come home and be closer to family. So, and he went through a process. He met with three clubs, I think, in the end. He met with the Kangaroos, Essendon and Carlton. And I reckon Essendon were going through their tough patch at the time too. So I remember meeting them at Windy Hill, and they had the plan to go to Tullamarine at the time, and they were selling them a bit of a vision. But I can't remember who was. I think Goody was in the room, Bomber Thompson. I don't know if Bomber was there anymore. And Adrian Dodoro. And it was a bit funny because they were a little bit all over the shop of what was happening at the time. So, and then, he'd obviously had a bit of a up and down time at Brisbane. And then we also went, met North, but then, he decided to go to Carlton in the end. So, but that was a bit of a funny period for him because, as you know, he lost his dad over that period. So that was a really hard you went to Arizona, didn't you? Mm. Well, you were still there. Yeah. He just got traded. And Eddie, his dad, was a brilliant guy. He was a massive Carlton man. So he was proud as punch. And then obviously, a few weeks later, he lost his dad. So which is a really hard part for him to go through. And I think everyone. But obviously extremely proud of the way he's bounced back through a lot of stuff. Sammy, like, he's been a really successful story.
Yeah, I think even just touching on that now, in terms of guys that you've managed that you're not most proud of, but yeah, I suppose most proud of and seen most growth in, he'd obviously be one of them. Who else is some guys that you've been really proud in the way they've sort of bounced back that, you know, people wouldn't know about, in sort of more terms of public knowledge?
Well, it's a hard one, mate, because I think footy's a hard injury, mate. Life's a roller coaster, right? Like, shit's not easy sometimes. So, and I think the hard part about footy is you have to be on all the time. So, if you're a guy that works, or a person, I shouldn't say a guy, a person that works 9-to-5 job, you can get through that work week vague. Like, you can go in and just get your shit done in and out and don't communicate that many with people around you, but you're good to go. Or you know what, you take the weekend off, have a couple of sick days and, you know, you're good. Where footy, you just can't do that. Like, you have to be mentally there. You know, people asking you questions in team meetings and you have to front up to play. It's just it's not that easy sometimes to be present all the time. So I think being part of that and helping build people from an early age is one of the most rewarding parts about the job. So, and I've had a few boys that have, Jesse Hogan, for example, he's had an incredible amount of things happen throughout his life that no one should have to go through. You know, he obviously lost his father and a couple of weeks later had testicular cancer, you know, like seeing, like, that was as confronting as you'll ever get, like being in the hospital with him through that period. Like, I touched on Sam losing his dad and I've had some really emotional times with players that on the back end of it, you know, it's satisfying getting through those really hard dips with them. Mm. So, there's a lot of players out there that'll have personal stories that they don't want me to mention. But, and there's also players that I've managed in the past that have probably acknowledged, had one call me 4 weeks ago and apologised to me and say, mate, I was a bit of a shit client for you and I put you through a lot of pain. I want to apologise for the way I acted and a few different things. And I still speak to him pretty half regularly, but he was probably more, and I was really proud of him that he's went and got some help and he's back in a way. So, you go through all walks of life, but, mate, it's super rewarding.
What about in terms of players? We spoke of Cripper earlier, and I know that Cripper's one that's, you know, one of your, you know, most work clients in terms of he's probably the biggest, one of the biggest guys you've got there and obviously very close with him. How would you explain Cripper as a person off field that people wouldn't know about that he'd be happy to talk about?
He's incredibly competitive, dude, just full stop. Like, he's a beast. But his want to get better in everything in his life, I don't reckon I've ever seen. from like even mates around me and stuff like that. Like he literally gets up in the morning and he's like, right, how do I get better today? So, and you would have seen it training and things like that, but it's probably off-field stuff as well. Like he jumps all into his finance stuff. He wants to get better and learn. He studies his ag science course, but he's doing the he's going to do post-grad in psych. So he's developed a love for probably the competitive sort of nature of life in a way. So he just did a course that I ended up doing as well called Compete to Create, which is a little bit around the mind and personal philosophy and a few things like that, which was really good. So and that talks about like sleep recovery and all a whole range of different things. But he loves that stuff. He just wants to keep getting better and better. So I think he's a good example of someone that got drafted at pick 13 and realized he had deficiencies, and if he didn't fix it up pretty quick, he'd get flushed out the system. And since then, he's just picked it up. And then any player that comes in, he just grabs him and says, this is how you get better.
Mm. I think it's a pretty cool story just because I've seen it work from his point of view. I think, you know, at a time where Carlton was one of those teams where people think, I think from outside perspective that people think when you go to a bad club that's not performing, but you're a young draft pick, that it's going to be easy for you. But I actually think it's actually worse because you don't nearly have... You don't actually have the leadership around you to develop into a player that you can get to. You see, you know, that all these young players that go to teams like Hawthorn in the past, that they have Luke Hodge, Sam Mitchell around them to show them how to be good. Whereas when you go to a team that's not going that well, it's normally a bit more of a everyone just fighting there for himself. And I think, you know, a lot of players can use that as an excuse why they didn't necessarily get the most out of them. Out of themselves.
I've got a bit of a theory on this still.
Is it the same?
I reckon.
Go for it.
Well, I actually reckon that some of the older boys in the list have gone through that really hard part and they know what it takes to get there. I reckon it's the list that have got a massive gap from ages 22 to 26 of guys that are actually continue to do that every single day, and you can watch them and how they've and how they're getting better. Where some of the older guys, like they might do Pilates in their own time or go to ice baths down at the beach because they're kids and stuff like that. And they pick up different things, but... I think Cripper's at the good age because he's 24, you know, or 25 or whatever he is now. But when he's like 22 to 3, 4, 5, the young boys now have been able to see how hard he's got there to get there.
Yeah, for sure. So, and that's what I think what happened with Carlton was there wasn't that gap in the middle. Like we had, obviously, there was the elite players above that were, you know, consistent performers at AFL and elite guys like Murph and Simo and Juddy and whatnot. But then there was probably a gap where... when we were coming through, there was, you know, a lot of us would just fall away to the VFL and Cripper played, you know, VFL. He got dropped. He was playing AFL. He was in and out. And like you said, people don't believe this, but it actually, he was getting dropped and was never given a game at all.
Yeah, mate, he's changed completely for the better. But it's funny looking back at those times, isn't it?
I do want to talk about club loyalty because recently there was announced, guys are leaving free agency, and this has happened twice. You know, when I was at Carlton, I remember Lockie Henderson said that he was going to leave and he was going to Geelong. And, Carlton pretty much, you know, they did. They cracked it at that stage and it was public knowledge. They pretty much said, okay, thank you, like, see you later. You know, he left, you know, with sort of five or six games to go.
Mm-hmm.
And it was reported again recently.
Mutual, Hendo's one?
Oh, it was mutual. Obviously mutual because he said he was leaving.
Yeah.
But, with clubs at the moment with the Giants.
Yeah.
Recently there was announced that they'd sort of done the same thing. Look, I don't know how that went down. I honestly don't. But I just think from my point of view with players leaving clubs, and just for reference for anyone that didn't see the article, was basically saying that, the list management had pretty much said to players, you know, if you don't want to be here, then, you pack up and leave. And I thought about that from my point of view, and if I was on an AFL list now, and I think things are starting to take a turn in terms of players at clubs now, and the ball being in the players' court or the ball being in the club's court. Like, I don't think that clubs can really demand that from players. Like, I don't think that they should have to. Clubs can trade players at will, they can delist players at will, but then they expect I'm not saying everyone expects this, but then, you know, in general, they expect players to be committed to the clubs. What's your view on that?
There's probably the other end of it too, that you don't see the loyalty that clubs give players behind the scenes. So there's probably contracts that go on or things that happen in footy clubs that aren't reported. So you probably only end up seeing one side, where like there's two examples in the space of, what, 7 years, 6 years. And I'm sure there's many more, but to stick up for clubs, like there's a lot of things clubs do for players that no one will ever know of. So yeah, footy is becoming a bit of a business, and I think players are starting to realise they need to look after themselves too and their families and get the most out of footy. But yeah, I still think there's a lot of loyalty there, mate. Like I look at some players that are in the system that have stuck fat at a club over a long period of time. Like you've got Murph at Carlton, for example. Like he probably had the chance to leave 10 times over for truckloads more money, but he never has, and it probably hasn't been a great period for the club either. You look at Nathan Jones from Melbourne. Like I love those type of stories of guys that have just said, you know what, I bleed for this footy club. I love it. I'm not leaving. No matter who's come at any point and offered them way more money or opportunity for premierships and things like that. So, but I think they get looked after on the flip side by the clubs. Hopefully they do getting that loyalty back.
Do you think that that's something though that's going to stay around? Like, is, you know, naming those guys now, Murph, Nathan Jones, you think of Scott Pendlebury played, you know, he's a bit of an exception to the rule because he's an absolute goat and he's a captain of the club and just broke the game's record. But even Cade Simpson, for example, going forward, there's always going to be the exception to the rule. But I don't know if players are going to be playing, you know, these one club players that play 300 to 400 games for one club. I think now, even from a club point of view, it's going to be a bit more of a business in terms of if there's going to be a team that's struggling, say like Carlton were and have been for a while, if they were in the modern day now, would they have tried to trade off players to get younger draft picks, or would they still been loyal to players?
That's a balance of list management, mate, I reckon, is being able to say, well, do we actually need a couple of players to go to get some in? So, and sometimes players might get a tap on the shoulder, which is the hardest part, especially they love the footy club. But it's very, very rare that a player that's really invested in a captain or that loves the place and wants it to get better and are going all right gets a tap to say, hey, we're going to trade you because we might be able to get a couple of draft picks. Like, it doesn't really happen unless there's a lot of work that goes on the background to manage that process. But there might be a drop-off, but I hope not. Mate, I love when players stay, and it's the frustration for me a little bit is not the like not celebrating them enough in the footy world. That gets to me a lot because players turn down a lot of money all the time to stay at footy clubs, and you can't report it. Like, it's not like I'm going to come out and say, well, my player's been offered $1 million and signed for 700 over, you know, 4 or 5 years. He's taken $1.5 million less, you know, like to stay. You don't hear those stories, so it's hard to tell. But there's so many of them out there, and players are incredibly loyal. And I suppose, like anything, there's a couple that might not be as loyal that probably give it a bad name for a couple of others.
Bainey, in your opinion, mate, football in 2021, how's it different? Is there anything in the works at the moment in terms of list management side, player contracts? Obviously, we touched on list sizes earlier, but even salary wages. I know the players have been cut down at the moment because of COVID-19 and what's been happening. What does it look like? Do you know what it looks like now?
It'll be – no one does, but it'll be different. Like, the whole competition is changing. Like, you look at the VFL program and the NAB League and different things like that, it's definitely going to change, but in what capacity, we don't know, mate. Hopefully, this whole thing's over at the end of the year and, you know, round one next year, it's full capacity. And I think that'll settle a lot of people, but the money in football needs to start coming in because, a lot of clubs have been hurt and there's a lot of good people that have lost their jobs in footy this year, unfortunately, that isn't good at all. So hopefully money can start flowing in and building it back up to what it's been.
Just on that as well, at the moment, what is the current contracts like for players? Is it still at 30% of their wage, or has it been brought up?
No, they're at 50% cut. 50% cut. I mean, if you look at it right across the full year, it's been 30% cut from October last year when footy wages start. But from when COVID hit, they've been at 50% the whole way through. So, and they're working through what next year looks like currently with the AFLPA and how that deal looks with list sizes and everything. But I expect them to probably have some cut next year, but I don't know what it'll be.
Mate, being a player manager, 10 years in the game, what do you love about your job?
We touched on it before, mate. The satisfaction you get out of it, and it's not necessarily... Some people think, oh, it must be amazing seeing players win flags and all that, and that's good, but, like, yeah, getting the satisfaction out of the smallest little things, like, it'll sound cheesy, but, like, with someone buying their first home and, you know, people in their family haven't bought a house before and seeing the joy that brings to people. Like looking at you now, mate, and the podcast you've built and little business and little side hustler and, yeah, it's just little wins along the way that get you so pepped up. Like you get the best job satisfaction out of it. It's not funny. So, yeah, I reckon that's the biggest part of it. And building relationships. Like I love the relationships. Footy's a good sport because – there's a lot of good people in it. And as you know, and you've gone from an environment where you've had so many people and made so many good friendships along the way, lifelong friendships. So yeah, building them with people and being really close and knowing that you've got their back through the shittest times in their life. Yeah, it's really rewarding.
Bane Train, thank you very much for coming on the Dylan Friends podcast. It's been very insightful, my friend. I wish I knew half of this stuff when I was in the game, but it's never too late to know this. Thanks again. Best of luck in the trade period. Hopefully make some big deals, and I'm looking forward to continuing our friendship for a long time.
Love it, mate. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Dylan Friends podcast. The show is produced by Dylan Buckley and Luca Ganano. Richard Stansbury looks after the audio and editing. Samuel Kenny Creative is responsible for branding and graphic design. And the show is recorded at 3AW Studios, Collins Street, Melbourne. If you would like to contact my son, head to dylanfriends.com or look me up in the white pages and I'll pass it on.
I know we're all in quarantine, but that doesn't mean we need to stop taking care of ourselves. We've all been guilty of letting things slide of late, but in saying that, it's time to get back on track. And that means being well-groomed. Dylan Friends this week is brought to you by Manscaped, who is the best in men's below-the-belt grooming. Manscaped offers precision-engineered tools for your family jewels. Manscaped has only just launched in Australia, so now you can be one of the first to experience their life-changing products here in Australia. Water-resistant, 90-minute shaves, and LED lights, just to name a few specs. We've all heard some horror stories of not using the right products, so let's look after ourselves with Manscaped. You'll be a new man. So jump on board, get 20% off plus free shipping with the code DIL123 at manscaped.com. The link will be in the show notes.